Look, I can wear sweats and I can get drunk. And hell, it looks, yeah, like I'm socializing.
Pajama parties.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, KB.
Hi. I'm sorry I'm late, but I went to the restroom before we were going to record, and there was a big-ass roach in there.
Oh, well, no.
I didn't know what to do with him, so I ran downstairs and let him go, but...
Well, you know what they say, better late than pregnant.
What did that have to do with anything?
She said I was late, did you?
Okay.
She's like, I'm so sorry I'm late, guys.
Which is fitting since we were just talking about pregnancy corsets.
Boom, going full circle.
Would you like to tell Katie Beth your idea?
Oh, so I was thinking, as a bonding experience for us and in celebration of the podcast, we should get tattoos of Victorian corsets.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be cool? Like,
I'm
an
down.
Illustration of, like, a Victorian corset.
I'm a maybe.
Okay, I'm taking that as a yes. So
take that as a yes. So we're gonna need to send Victorian corset illustration ideas.
Yes.
Okay, great. So we'll get on that this week. There's a whole bunch of ones here that I'm looking at.
Yes.
And I'm super into them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So we'll talk about that later. How's everyone's New Year so far?
It's been good.
Good.
To celebrate, I did go to Wabi House and had ramen.
I know. I know you did. I really considered joining you the other day.
So I asked a guy to join me because I've been talking to this guy online.
Yeah.
And one day we were talking and it was like right after we went, and I was like, oh, I just got back from dinner, like, oh, I might explode. And he's like, oh, where'd you go? Well, I went to Wabi House. He's like, I love that place. So I think I'm gonna marry him.
Good. That sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Wedding reception at Wabi House too.
Obviously. KB, what about you?
It's been a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm back at work because before everyone else gets back, we have to do like training and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Mm. Our first day of training was pretty low key, you know. But our second day, let me tell you what I had training on. I had to go for a training for how to react to active shooters. At which they made us watch the Columbine video.
Oh, that seems highly unnecessary.
It was rough. It was a lot. Then after that, I went to go to a training about how to stop people from bleeding.
Great.
And then I went to a training on suicide prevention. So it was a lot in one day.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it was a lot.
That sounds like the onboarding when I started working at the zoo. Because it was like, this is what you do when an active shooter. This is what you do when an animal gets out.
Yeah.
By the way, Ashley, you can't pet it. I've already learned that.
I know. You've already told me.
But I think if it's like an otter, you can pet it.
Well, but I want to pet lions. I mean, not that I wouldn't pet an otter, but...
I heard that they do bite.
I mean, I'm fine with that.
I got to pet no copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was, apparently, I was too, because they were like, oh, be really gentle and, like, you know, be kind of, don't go too fast because you might startle it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, and I thought I was going the right amount of speed, but apparently I was too eager. I got excited about petting an animal. Guilty as charged.
Sorry, I was taking a sip from my Bob Ross positive energy drink.
So I was watching Bob Ross earlier today.
It sounds like you need it after this week.
I did. Oh my gosh. And I've got to spend time with Travis a little bit this weekend. So that's been good.
Oh, that's good.
That was like a good decompress after that. Also, there's problems with my car. So right after I went through all that training, I had to go pay a ton for my car to get fixed.
Oh, that's great.
It was a great day. But I was watching Bob Ross earlier, and it got me to thinking about how does he not get paint all over his like nice crisp blue shirts all the time?
He's that good.
Because sometimes he'll like, he's got his little palette thingy and he's got where he's mixed it at the bottom and he holds it real close to his body. And I'm like, how did you not just like paint
all of your shirt?
Yeah. It'd be all over me.
Oh, yeah.
But we're not all Bob Ross. He's secretly a sorcerer.
Yeah. I'm also a messy painter and I end up just wearing.
Yeah. Well, anyway, welcome to Legendary Lasses. I'm Ashley.
I'm KB.
And I'm Sally.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, y'all. Felt like it's been a year since I've talked to y'all.
I can't believe it's been that long. So basically for this week, before we got like too deep into our first series, I wanted to do something kind of fun, lighthearted, and relevant. So today, we're going to be talking about a lady who I'm going to say is pretty well known.
Me?
No.
Tina Fey?
No.
Okay.
But we're going to be talking about some stuff that was new to me, and I think kind of exploring parts of her that people don't really know.
Okay.
So who are we talking about?
Do you want to take any guesses?
Are they still alive?
No.
Marie Curie.
That's a good guess, and I did almost do her, but no.
Okay. Eleanor Roosevelt.
No.
Rosie the Riveter.
No.
Jackie Kennedy.
No.
Who then? I'm
KB?
I'm not going to guess because I'm pretty sure I know who it is.
Did you look at the poem I sent you?
I didn't, but it's about Thoreau. Okay. So I'm like, I watched something recently that's put me in that kind of frame of mind.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I know who it is.
So today we're going to be talking about Louisa May Alcott.
Yup.
And I thought it was timely since Little Women just came out.
Have you seen that yet?
No, I don't want to.
It's so good.
Dallas Theater Center is also doing a production of it right now.
Yes, they are. Yep.
I saw it with one of my aunts and a cousin and my mom's stepmom.
Okay.
It was so good.
Would you go see it again?
Yes.
Can we have movie day?
We should. It's so good.
Okay.
And we should go eat ramen before.
Yes. Yes. Always yes.
KB, we're going to take you to Wabi House and you're going to love it.
Okay.
I'm so good. Just a warning though, you'll crave it every single day afterwards.
Yeah, no, you won't stop thinking about it.
Until the day you die.
Like, I should have a punch card for how many times I go.
You really should see if they have a loyalty card.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, Louisa May Alcott was born on November 29th, 1832 in Germantown, which is now part of Philadelphia. Amos Bronson Alcott, her father, was a transcendentalist and educator. KB, do you want to explain transcendentalism?
I'm going to try. I took a class. So, isn't it kind of like the root being transcend, like you transcend yourself. There's like a greater something out in the somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's so specific.
And
you like transcend yourself, your mortalness or whatever.
Right.
And aspire to be that.
Yeah. So it's a philosophical movement of the 1820s and 30s, and it basically came around as a reaction to the general state of intellectualism and spirituality of the time. So Abby May, her mother, was also a social worker. And fun little fact, the day Louisa was born was also her dad's birthday. And he turned 33 on the day that she was born.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so Louisa is the second of four daughters that would be born in the Alcott family. The
man, sharing a birthday with your dad.
I know. I know.
That'd be the double birthday party all the time.
That would be, like, how do you have a birthday for, like, a 34-year-old and a 1-year-old?
She must have either loved it or did not like that at all, because my birthday's 2 days after Christmas, and, like, there are times where I'm just kind of indifferent about it.
Yeah, that's fair.
And they're just like, what's your birthday? And I was like, meh.
That's fair.
Sorry.
There's so many holidays right around then, too. It's just like, what do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah. That sucks, Sally.
My grandma made the executive decision that we're going to celebrate it in June.
Okay.
So, and why? I was like, well, I'm sorry that my birthday doesn't fall on a convenient date for you, so.
I'm sorry.
So we're going to celebrate a half birthday.
Convenient.
Yeah. Well, like, a couple of years ago, I did the half birthday. Okay. So we did it in June. But it's like a week after my brother's birthday.
Oh.
Yeah.
Y'all need to pick a month where nobody has birthdays.
I think August.
There you go.
It's like hot.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to tell you then.
Can we make a new month and then that'll just be my birthday month?
So you're going to turn into Julius Caesar?
Yes.
Okay, sure.
I won't have his demise, but
surrounded by friends.
I will beware the Ides of March.
Okay. Hopefully I'm not Brutus in this situation.
All right, let's get back. I'm sorry, we're sidetracking.
So anyway, Louisa was the second of four daughters in the May Alcott family. And the eldest sister was Anna Bronson Alcott. And then born after Louisa was Elizabeth Sewell Alcott. And then the baby of the family was Abigail May Alcott. In 1834, the family moved to Boston, where Amos started an experimental school and joined the Transcendentalist Club that boasted members such as Ralph Waldo. Ooh, okay. Such as Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. Most of Louisa's early education would come from lessons with Henry David Thoreau, actually. And some of her other tutors included Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, and Julia Ward Howe.
I have a question.
Yes.
Was there like a big trend of like the three names thing? Like, where's Sarah Jessica Parker in this?
That's a good
question.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do know what you mean. I think everyone just really went by their full names a lot of the time.
See, I couldn't do that. I mean, like, the only time you use a middle name is when someone's really mad at you. That's like, Ralph Waldo Emerson! Turn off the light when you leave the room!
I mean, you've got a good point.
That's the only way you like to use a like to test the middle name, you know, is when you're mad at someone.
That's true. But I mean, it's also a time where everyone is referred to as like, oh, it's Mr. Emerson. Like, we also don't call each other like, oh, Miss Mendoza, how are you today?
Yeah, no, fuck that.
Well, anyway, these lessons would inspire her to write the poem Thoreau's Floop, which is based on her time at Walden Pond. And Kay Beth is going to actually read that poem for us.
Yeah, I'm going to try. So this is Thoreau's Flute, a poem. We, sighing, said, "Our Pan is dead. His pipe hangs mute beside the river. Around his wistful sunbeams quiver, but music's airy voice is fled. Spring mourns as for untimely frost. The bluebird chants a requiem. Willow blossom waits for him. The genius of the wood is lost." Then from the flute, untouched by hands, there came a low harmonious breath. For such as he, there is no death. His life, the eternal life, commands. Above man's aims, his nature rose. The wisdom of a just continent, and tuned to poetry, life's prose. Haunting the hills, the stream, the wild, swallow and aster, lake and pine, to him grew human or divine, fit mates for this large-hearted child. Such homage nature ne'er forgets, and yearly on the coverlid, neath which her darling lieth hid, will write his name in violets. To him no vain regrets belong, whose soul, that finer instrument, gave to the world no poor lament, but wood notes ever sweet and strong. O lonely friend, he still will be, a potent presence though unseen, steadfast, sagacious, and serene. Seek not for him, he is with thee.
So I think from this poem, you can definitely see the impact that transcendentalism had on her growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was actually published in 1863, so when she's a little bit older, it's kind of her reflecting on it. But yeah, I think you can definitely see the impact that these transcendentalist creatives had on her, because it's very nature-y, and it's very transcendentalist.
Yeah.
But anyway, Amos's views on education and child rearing seem to have been very tough and strict for all of his children. And he was supposedly known to be fond of, quote unquote, the sweetness of self-denial.
Oh.
It seems he did also have trouble with Louisa's independent behavior that she exhibited even as a younger child. These views, in addition to some moments of mental instability on Amos's part, really shaped Louisa's worldview and started her continuous strive for perfection, which is a larger goal for transcendentalists. A second major worldview shaping lesson actually came from her mother. Due to a failing marriage and Amos's inability to provide fully for the family, Abby May began to show signs of resentment for her husband. Part of this resentment seems to have come from Abby's belief that Amos was unable to see the sacrifices that she and their daughters had made for the family. She began to resign this idea of thoughtlessness on Amos's part to a larger social issue of the inequality of the sexes that was beginning to be brought up in conversation in America at the time. This recognition of the problems of a misogynistic society and a passion to right wrongs done to women was actually passed down to Louisa. Now, Boston was not the family home for very long. Over the next 18 to 20 years, the Alcott family would move about 22 times across mostly the northeast of America.
Wow.
Yeah. I won't go into all of the different moves, but there are a few interesting short anecdotes about some of the moves that I think will kind of help shape this history. So in 1840, the family moved to Hosmer Cottage that sat on 2 acres of land along the Sudbury River in Concord, Massachusetts. The years they spent here would be described as idyllic. And then in 1843, the family would leave Concord and move with 6 other members of the, I think it's consociate family, to Harvard. So
to have it.
Consociate family was a group of agrarian transcendentalists. They set up a farm in Harvard that they named Utopian Fruitland.
Okay.
And it became like a agrarian commune for the specific group of transcendentalists.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. So Amos and another transcendentalist, Charles Lane, were actually the founding members of Utopian Fruitland.
They couldn't choose a better name?
No, they couldn't, I guess. Just
what
to get
would
it...
our commune be named?
Oh, God. Not Fruitland.
No, Utopian Fruitland sounds like a really bad board game.
Or a really gross cereal.
Yeah.
But just to give you a little bit more info on this commune, I'm going to read a quote from The New Age, which was published in November 1st, 1845. And it was written by Charles Lane in 1843. More about it can be found on walden.org, which is the website for the Walden Woods Project by the Thoreau Institute. And so Charles Lane... this is a pretty lengthy quote, you guys, so bear with me. It's all like, this full quote I'm going to read is three sentences. Charles Lane writes, "After many years passed in admiration of a better order in human society, with a constant expectation that some beginning would shortly be made, and a continued reliance that some party would make it, the idea has gradually gained possession of my mind that it is not right thus to linger for the leadings of other men, but that each should at once proceed to live out the proposed life to the utmost possible extent. Assured that the most potent hindrance to goodness abides in the soul itself, next in the body, thirdly in the house and family, and in the fourth degree only in our neighbors or in society at large, I have daily found less and less reason to complain of public institutions or of the dilatoriness of reformers and genetic minds. Animated by pure reform principles, or rather by pure creative spirit, I have not hesitated to withdraw, as far and as fast as hopeful prudence dictated, from the practices and principles of the old world." So, basically... he's one of the people that is going to be like, oh, if you don't agree with the judgments being made by society at large, leave the society. Which I can understand.
Yeah, because, I mean, you hear that a lot now. It's like, you don't like the rules we have? Well, then get out!
Right. Like, I think it's something that we're kind of used to hearing even today. But it's also at a time in America where... you can do that and stay in your own country because you could just move to where no one else is.
And just kind of, like, do your own thing.
Yeah, and, like, no one's going to really bother you because there's plenty of room.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place for, I think, a creative person like Louisa to grow up.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Alcott family resided at Utopian Fruitland for only a year before moving into rented rooms elsewhere.
Why?
I'm not
Why are they constantly
sure.
moving?
I'm not entirely sure. I think part of it is Amos. I think he has to go... I mean, think about it this way. He's the only male in the family.
Yeah.
He has four daughters.
And so he's just following work.
I think he's following teaching jobs where they go.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my best guess. I couldn't really find anything during my research, mostly because I was focused on Louisa for the most part. But yeah, that's my best guess.
Okay.
After moving into the rented rooms, Abigail May Alcott actually inherited some money. And then they also received financial help from Emerson, in which the family was able to purchase a homestead for themselves in Concord. And they moved to this homestead on April 1st, 1845, and they named it Hillside. However, this too would not be their final family home. In 1852, they would sell Hillside to another owner who renamed it The Wayside. And do you want to guess who this new owner was?
Ralph Waldo Emerson.
No.
Henry David Thoreau.
No.
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Definitely not.
It was past me, and then I go invest in Apple.
When did they sell it?
1852.
1852.
Thomas Jefferson. No, that's later. That's way too late. I'm just guessing.
I don't know.
Don't listen to me. Andrew Jackson. No. Abraham Lincoln.
No.
I'm just guessing people.
Give us a clue.
It's another author.
Poe.
No.
Whitman.
No.
I don't know.
You guys, the new owner was Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Dang it. I was like, other authors of that period. He was the only one left.
I know. You named every other one. I was like, it's going to be the next one she says. But it's really interesting because if you decide to read more about this time, especially anything with like literary history specific, you're going to see that there's a lot of money lending and helping out between creatives at this time in America. And and it's very strange. Like, I can't think of another group of people except maybe the Lost Generation.
They're supporting local art.
I mean, yeah, but it's also just like helping your neighbor, but your
artist
neighbor just
supporting
happens to be Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Artist supporting artist. That's what it is.
Yeah. So the last move we're going to talk about is perhaps the most important. So in 1857, the Alcotts returned to Concord once again, and a year later, the family would find a new homestead and a two-story clapboard farmhouse named Orchard House. Now, this house would become famous, as this is where Louisa May Alcott wrote and set her novel, Little Women. The house is still standing and can be toured. It is located at 399 Lexington Road, Concord, Massachusetts, and it was designated as a historic house museum in 1962.
And so, are we going on a road trip?
Yes, ma'am, because the museum is open every day from 11 to 3.
So, road trip, ladies!
Road trip! This would be, like, a really cool trip to make.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have to do a history house road trip and do, like, Orchard House, Lizzie Borden's house, Emily Dickinson's house.
We need to do a Lizzie Borden episode.
Yes. Again.
Again.
Or when we could go for our witch trials stuff.
Ooh.
And just go to Massachusetts and have, like,
of them.
KB.
Yeah.
Yes. Can we please?
We should.
Okay.
Gonna I'm gonna it. Start on the road trip playlist right now.
Perfect. So I think this is probably a good time to take a break. I wanted to kind of get the family history background done, and then we're gonna focus on Louisa's role in the family through her literary success when we come back.
Okay.
All right. Bye. Right. How was your break?
Well, I had no further roach incidents, so I'm gonna call it good.
I'm getting the playlist started. I'm open for suggestions. So,
can we name it Witchy Woman?
I was just thinking that.
Yes.
Yes.
And it'll be lots of Stevie Nicks. I hope you're okay with this.
I was about to say lots of Fleetwood Mac, and yeah.
And what's that one song? I Put a Spell on You.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That one. Okay. So, since we spent some time getting background on the family as a whole, I think helped shape Louisa, I want to spend the rest of this time more on her role in the family, and then we'll get to her literary success. So, due to poverty, Louisa began working and providing income for the family at a young age. Among her jobs included being a seamstress, a domestic helper, governess, teacher, and later writer.
Governess. was this, I'm bringing in Sound of Music. Was this, come on.
No. I'm sorry.
I'm going to ask that every time you mention a governess. I hope you're aware.
Oh, great.
What?
Sound of Music, being a governess.
What a, what?
Nothing. Just go with it. Just go with it.
I'm very confused.
Just stop thinking about it. It makes sense if you don't think about it. It's
you think about it. You think about it. Don't think about it.
Stop thinking about it.
So her sisters also worked as a seamstress or seamstresses. And her mother started taking on social work jobs among Irish immigrants, sort of like Marmee and Little Women.
Huh.
During this time, only the youngest sister, Abigail May, she was the only one who was allowed to attend public school. And I think you can see the sort of autobiographical portions of Little Women when you look at the family dynamics of the Alcott family during this time, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Alcott is also quoted as saying, "I wish I was rich, I was good, and we were all a happy family this day." And this began her desire that drove her to do anything she could to not be poor for the rest of her life. However, due to the pressures in the family to provide income, writing became an emotional and a creative outlet for Louisa. She published her first book in 1849 at the age of 17, and it was titled Flower Fables. And in this book, it contained a selection of tales originally written for Ellen Emerson, who was Ralph Waldo Emerson's daughter.
Okay.
In 1847, the family's home, Hillside, we're at Hillside during this time, actually also served as a refuge for a quote-unquote fugitive slave for 1 week as a stop in the Underground Railroad.
Hmm.
And during this time, the family actually invited Frederick Douglass to their home and had many, many discussions with him about abolitionism.
Hmm.
Yeah. Louisa at this time would also read the Declaration of Sentiments, which was published by the Seneca Falls Convention advocating for women's suffrage.
Yep.
Which led to Louisa actually being the first woman registered to vote in Concord, Massachusetts for a school board election.
Ooh, another song on our playlist, Suffragette City by David Bowie.
Obviously. Good call. Sorry. But yeah, I didn't know that she was the first woman registered to vote in Concord.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's so cool to me. The 1850s brought a lot of hardship for the Alcott family. Not that the rest of their life wasn't hard. But during this period, Louisa would find comfort at the Boston Theater. And while she was working with them, she wrote a play called The Rival Prima Donnas. And the script was later burned. Sorry. The script was later burned by Louisa due to a pretty bad quarrel between the actresses who were set to play the roles. Which I think
that
is
sounds just amazing. I need to read the script.
Except it doesn't exist anymore.
I don't care. I want to meet with the ghost of Louisa, and then she'll rewrite it.
Okay. I just think that's so funny. And supposedly in 1857, this is less funny, but supposedly in 1857, Alcott was unable to find any work at all and mm-hmm. was said to have contemplated suicide.
Oh.
However, during that year, she read Elizabeth Gaskell's biography of Charlotte Bronte and found many parallels between Bronte and herself.
Oh, write about the Brontes like someone else that we know of.
Yeah, but Charlotte is right now, actually,
I'm remaining a silent partner on this.
Are you flipping me? If I was in the same room with you, you would be flipping me off.
I'm not flipping you off. I just sheepishly lowered my head and maybe blushed.
Again, I'm going to say these two words.
Don't.
Rahel Bronte.
Don't. I've been haunted by Branwell a lot this week.
Oh, dear.
Oh, I asked if he congratulated you on getting your master's.
In a way.
What I said was, he said, "You're done with grad school. Now what are you doing? You have plenty of time."
Yeah, that was pretty much
now you can watch Tu Wong Fu.
That was pretty much it.
I know how Branwell haunts you.
Yeah. It was like, oh, great, you're done with grad school. And that's weird. You wrote your final paper about my sisters. And I was like, ah, yeah. Sorry. But anyway, in 1858, Elizabeth Sewell Alcott, which was the sister born right after Louisa, unfortunately died. And the oldest sister, Anna, got married to John Pratt. And both of these events convinced Louisa that this was basically the end of their sisterhood. That the sisterhood was going to be forever broken because they're missing two sisters now, really.
It's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. In 1860, though, Alcott began writing for the Atlantic Monthly, which is where that poem, Thoreau's Flute, would first be published in 1863. But with the outbreak of the Civil War, Louisa signed up to be a nurse, and she actually served at the Union Hospital in Georgetown. However, she was only there for 6 weeks. Originally, she was stationed there for 3 months to serve as a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
However, she became deathly ill after contracting typhoid.
Oh, no.
Yeah. During this time, she did write letters home about her time at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And after she was better and the war was over, these letters would be revised and published in the Commonwealth, which was a Boston anti-slavery newspaper. And the letters would be published under the title Hospital Sketches. This is the first publication that gained Louisa recognition for her observational humor and political satire. And the letters contained writings about hospital mismanagement and observation of the callousness of some of the surgeons she interacted with at the hospital.
I'm thinking back to our episode about James Miranda Berry, and she'd be walking through, like, dust in this hospital.
Yeah. Once the letters were revised for publication, it actually featured a character named Tribulation Periwinkle, which is a character name if I've heard one.
Tribulation Periwinkle.
Yes. Huh. And this character goes on a building's roman journey from innocence to maturity and is a quote-unquote serious and eloquent witness to the horrors of Civil War hospitals.
Oh.
Her novel, Moods, would be published in 1864, and it was also based on her experiences during the Civil War. It was also received quite well for the time.
How old was she at this point?
This was in 1860 through 64. So she's... I can't do math. Why are you asking me this?
I just want to know, what year was she born?
1832.
So she would have been about 30, like 28 to 32 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes me feel so accomplished.
Same. And here is where we get to something that is even more interesting. And it's something I definitely did not see coming when I was doing my research. Like, it blew my mind. And I'm very curious if you guys have ever heard this about her as well.
Did she have a dog?
Probably. But in the mid-1860s, Louisa began writing under a nom de plume of A.M. Barnard. And I kind of wonder if this was inspired by reading Charlotte Bronte's biography.
Yeah, because they went under a pseudonym too. All of them.
They did, yeah.
Hers was, I forget, but their last name was Bell, all of them, right?
Yeah, so Anne was Acton Bell, Emily was Ellis Bell, and Charlotte was
Currer or something.
Currier Bell, yeah. So I kind of wonder if it's inspired by that a little bit.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
But the books published under this name are considered to be quote unquote passionate, fiery novels and quote sensational stories. And they usually focused on espionage and revenge.
That's probably why. The pen name.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
But like, have you guys heard that about her?
No.
That seems crazy to me.
I think maybe because so much of her legacy is just Little Women.
But Little Women's not even done at this time.
Yes, but I'm saying, like, when we look back historically.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
About what it is we talk about her. You know, right. Since so much of it is Little Women. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, like, I don't want to say well-mannered girls, because there's sometimes that they are very, like, active and whatever, but these girls that are very concerned with, like, morals and this, you know, perfecting yourself sort of attitude.
Yeah.
That if we knew she had some spicy stories, that might change our view of her.
That's true. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So these novels published under the pen name were considered like young adult stories, and a couple of titles include A Long Fatal Love Chase and Pauline's Passion and Punishment.
Oh, no.
Usually her protagonists are very smart and strong and independent, which I think we also see in Little Women.
Yes.
But it's quite unusual for the time. I mean, we still have this problem today of, like, how do we portray strong, independent characters, right? Like, we talked a little bit about that during, what was it, Bad Behavior?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so anyway, during this time, she would also start writing books for children. And after they would become successful, she would not return to writing novels for adults. So in 1868, part one of Little Women was published under the title Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy. And originally, she delayed quite a bit on publishing this novel due to its autobiographical nature of their childhood. And she thought herself not the best candidate to write stories for girls, despite her publishers urging her to do so. The second part of Little Women was published in the next year, 1869, under the title Good Wives. But this second part, titled Good Wives, today is actually published together with Little Women, so it just makes one book.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the part that follows the March sisters into adulthood.
Okay.
In 1871, though, she would follow up the Little Women series with Little Men, which follows Jo March at Plumfield School that she founded with her husband, Professor Bear, at the end of Little Women. Spoiler alerts, I guess, if you haven't seen anything.
Big old spoiler.
And then in 1886, the book Joe's Boys was published, which concluded the March family saga.
Yeah.
Now, Little Women was well received in its time, and it's obviously still renowned today. As it was a fresh representation of daily life for young girls, it became very popular. And one critic wrote that it was, quote, the very best of books to reach the hearts of the young of any age from 6 to 60. And with its success, Louisa would actually shy away from attention. And something that I found really funny while I was researching is that apparently when, like, fans or important people would come to the house to discuss kind of her literary success, she would actually pretend to be the maid of the house. Because I think she didn't know what to do with the attention, honestly. And despite Little Women being semi-autobiographical and the character of Jo being based on Louisa herself, who does get married, Louisa actually never married. And in an interview with Louise Chandler Moulton, who did a lot of magazine work back in during this time. She also did Harper's Bazaar. In this interview, though, Louisa would explain her quote-unquote spinsterhood, saying, I think y'all are going to be shocked by this.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so Louisa's quote is, I am more than half persuaded that I am a man's soul put by some freak of nature into a woman's body. Because I have fallen in love with so many pretty girls and never once the least bit by a man.
Huh.
What?
Yes. However, Louisa's diary seems to tell a little bit of a different story.
Okay.
So while Louisa was in Europe, it would appear that she fell quite madly in love with a Polish man named Ladislaw Laddie. I'm going to try this last name, you guys. I think it's Vinewski, I think.
Okay.
But Laddie would actually be the inspiration for Lori in Little Women. And this was confirmed by Louisa herself.
Okay.
But here's where it gets complicated.
Okay.
Of course.
The portion of her diary that contained information about her romance with Laddie would be deleted in her diary by Louisa prior to her death.
Okay.
So we have this quote from her, and then we know that at some point she's writing about this romance with Laddie.
Mm-hmm.
But then she makes sure it's like crossed out or whatever in her diary before she dies.
Huh.
I think that's interesting. I don't know if there's anything you guys want to say.
I don't know. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, I guess, you know, we'll never know for sure.
Yeah.
But that brings up a lot of questions, I think.
I wish we had a way, way back machine so we can ask her.
Dude, if I had a way, way back machine, I would be the happiest.
She would tell us, you know?
I don't know.
We'd have to gain her trust.
Obviously, we'd have to be friends with her.
Yeah.
I think she would like us.
I make a great spinach artichoke dip. I have a great recipe for chocolate chip cookies. I will make her my friend.
Okay. But yeah,
I have a good recipe for mac and cheese.
Oh. Well, anytime you want to make that, Sally, you let me know.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think it makes it a little complicated as far as like researching her goes.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, we know there's information, but that information has been discarded by the author.
Yeah.
So she's hiding something more.
Yeah. But then she gives this interview where she says, you know, sort of a scandalous thing at the time, I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And I think even today when we read that quote, it brings up a lot of questions as far as, you know, it's different, but the phrase that we would use is how she identifies herself.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't know that she thought necessarily in those same lines that we think about it today, obviously, and we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
But I think it brings up a lot of questions about her and is perhaps why we don't talk about some of her life past Little Women, is because it's complicated and we're not sure what to do about those gray areas, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting. I wanted to bring that up.
Hmm.
And I hope somebody else emails us and is like, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
But, anyway, despite never marrying, Louisa would actually take in her niece, who is also named Louisa. And
that must have been confusing at the house. Louisa! Louisa!
So she ends up calling her niece Lulu. I think that is probably to help differentiate. But she takes in her niece after Abigail May, the youngest sister, actually dies of childbed fever, which is just... don't have kids during this time, you guys.
No.
Anyway, Louisa would care for Lulu as her own daughter until her death. Mm. And in 1877, Louisa helped found the Women's Educational and Industrial Union in Boston. She would also suffer from chronic illnesses leading up to her death. She reportedly had severe vertigo and symptoms that many think would be related to mercury poisoning.
Oh.
And they attributed this to her time at the hospital as a nurse during the Civil War when she contracted typhoid, because the prescription she was given was a mercury compound. However, modern biographers have offered the explanation as an autoimmune disease being more likely, but it's also important to remember that mercury poison can often be a trigger for autoimmune diseases.
Oh.
So they can kind of play into each other. But there's a continuing debate about Louisa's health because a portrait of Louisa later in life reveals her to have a rash on her cheek, which is characteristic of lupus.
Huh.
Yeah. What's of interest to me about this is that if she did have a chronic illness, she was rather fond of taking exercise and staying healthy. And in her journals, Louisa makes notes of going on runs up until the day she died, which is very taboo at the time.
It's even taboo now. Running, no thank you.
Well, but no, like, in a way you're right. Like, it wasn't that long ago that the first marathon runner lady was harassed on the marathon, you know?
Yeah.
So in a way she's finding a way to exercise that's also challenging gender norms. And it's actually something that she encouraged her readers to partake in too, because she features her characters running a lot.
Yeah.
I just think that's interesting. If she did have a chronic illness, that she's like, she has to get up and go to go running every day. Like, geez. Anyway, on March 6, 1888, Louisa May Alcott would die of a stroke in Boston. And this was 2 days after her father's death.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, I know.
She was born on his birthday.
Yeah.
And died 2 days after his death day.
Yeah.
Were they really close?
It seems like they had a kind of a rocky relationship. I think childhood is pretty rough. I didn't put it in my notes here, but I do know that after her time serving as a nurse, her father did write and publish a poem for her that basically boasts about how proud he is to have a daughter to take on such a role and just how proud he is as her father. So I think it probably got better as they got older, but I think it was pretty rocky from childhood.
Yeah.
At the time of her death, though, her niece Lulu was only 8 years old. And I'm not sure what happened to Lulu. I couldn't find anything about where did she go. I'm assuming the only sister left at this time would have been the eldest, Anna.
Yeah.
So it's possible she may have gone to stay with Anna. But I'm not sure. There was nothing about Lulu. And I thought this was interesting that people made note of this. But reportedly, Louisa's last known words were, "Is it not meningitis?" And I don't know why people cared to carry that on.
Huh.
Yeah. But anyway, she is buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord. Nearby Emerson, Thoreau, and Hawthorne on what is known as Author's Ridge. And in 1996, Louisa was conducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. And in her time, she published 20 novels, some anonymously and some under that pen name we talked about, and over 130 short stories or collections of stories that included poetry.
Wow. Oh, dang.
I'm going to post a selection of titles on our website as my book recommendations for the episode. But obviously you can find a full list online of her bibliography. I did not realize she wrote such a plethora of lines.
Yeah.
That's incredible to me. Like, that is a large body of work for someone.
Yes. Yeah.
And what year did she die?
1888.
Mm-hmm. So she was in her 50s.
Yeah.
Wow.
But really, like, she's publishing really from the time she's 17.
Yeah.
That's like that's a long time. But it's still like a very large body of work. I think especially for us to know that many titles of someone from this period is pretty rare, especially a lady. I think there's probably a few male authors that we have like a large body of work from. I would also recommend Harriet Risen's biography. It's called Louisa May Alcott, The Woman Behind Little Women. This biography was also turned into a film for PBS directed by Nancy Porter, and it's good. And that's Louisa May Alcott.
I learned a lot about her, I feel like. Yeah. I watched Little Women. I looked up a little bit more about her, but I feel like I learned even more than that.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was just so surprised by, like, how much she did. And, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew she was involved in, like, abolitionism and the suffragette movement.
Yeah.
But I don't think I realized what scale she was involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just, like, how many people she knew at this time who were, like, rather famous.
Yeah.
there was so much I didn't really know about her, and I thought it was very interesting that she has such an exciting life, but we kind of think of her as, oh, the author of Little Women.
Yeah.
So, again, kind of one of the more famous people we've covered, but I think there's a lot about her life that we just don't talk about because we're focused on her novel. Mm-hmm. But she's very, very interesting. And I'm going to be doing my own further research on her, I think.
Yeah.
I want to know more about this diary.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Do you guys have anything you want to say about Louisa May Alcott?
My only thing would be, and it's about kind of what gets put into the canon of what we read.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From this, I took a class on this period specifically in American literature.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't even mention her.
Yeah, and isn't it weird that she's so involved with the other authors that you read for that class?
Right, yes. Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, you know, we read all of that. And I think it's odd that no one even mentions her. And I think, again, part of it is because we've sort of written her off as like, oh yeah, she wrote Little Women.
And that's it.
Young women read those books and then that's it, you know. And
but like, even when you think about Little Women, it has such a transcendentalist take on it with like,
it does. Yeah,
with like Jo realizing she's a flawed person and wanting to better herself but still be her, like I think,
and all of them,
yeah,
all of the sisters, and I would say most of the characters, especially the younger ones, go through some kind of personal transformation.
Yeah.
You know, Lori goes from being, I don't care about anything, to like, I've got to be serious now.
Right.
Amy has been so concerned with money and all of this stuff for a long time, but then ultimately chooses more what her heart wants. And mm-hmm. you know, like, there's just so many changes in them as people. They grow as people.
Yeah.
And it's all of them.
Yeah, and it seems strange to me that we write that off as like almost a
like this is how little girls should behave, but it's like no, it's how everyone should behave.
Yeah.
You know?
What were those called during Jane manners books?
Yeah.
Like we write it off as almost a manner book.
Yeah.
I don't like that term.
I know.
And even mothers now, I feel like are, you know, when they get, when they have girls who are up into like their older childhood starting to change into almost tween teen years, they're like, you want them to behave? Let them read Little Women, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
So even now it's something that I feel like sometimes mothers will use to be like, here you go.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that because I think I was probably 13 or 14. And I had gone, I was homeschooled. This was before I went to like community college for my classes. But I went to art class and my mom picked me up and it had been kind of like a rough week. I had really bad depression and anxiety stuff. And so it had been a really rough week so far. My mom picked me up and was like, hey, I rented us a movie and I bought us tortilla chips and guacamole and we're going to watch a movie.
Okay.
And I was like, great. That movie turned out to be Little Women, and I had never seen it or heard about it before then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was supposed to be kind of like this, hey, everybody goes through some tough stuff, but they turn out all right in the end.
Yeah.
Little did she know that it just furthered my, I'm going to study Victorian literature. But no, like that's, like, it's a very dear memory to me, like, experiencing this for the first time with my mom.
Yeah.
And so I think there is something to be said about that, but don't use it as a manner book.
No.
Use it as like a mother-daughter bonding experience.
Yeah.
Or like a big like milestone book, or it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because I can remember reading like a one of those abridged versions, you know?
Yeah. I remember seeing those when I was younger, but I never read it.
Yeah.
I read Phantom of the Opera instead.
Because, man, if you've only ever seen the musical or watched like the movie and stuff, read the book. It's so interesting.
Yes, it is.
It's a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Ugh, I love Phantom.
But I think that is interesting about the canon. I think you and I talk about the canon of literature so much.
Since I took that, and it was that class that was about, all of the authors during this period. Since I took that class, I think about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is our canon? Why is it that way? What are the contributing factors to that?
Yeah.
And why are certain things excluded?
Yeah.
And I think about that a lot.
Yeah. I think since you took that class and we've had more conversations on it, I've been thinking about it a lot.
Yeah.
And then I took another class with that same professor this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like furthered me into like, why are we reading this? Like, there's no reason. These men were never told they needed to edit their fucking work.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I want to devise my own canon of American literature.
Yeah.
And it's going to be Emily Dickinson,
mm-hmm.
Louisa May Alcott, but not Little Women. I'm going to throw some stuff on there that we haven't read of hers.
Yeah.
You guys, we should have a Legendary Lasses book club.
Yeah.
That like redoes the literary canon using only women.
Yeah.
I like it.
How do we?
I'll say women and or people of color.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
How do we start this?
I don't know. We got to pick a book.
We got to get a bunch of stickers and we just slap them on books.
We can't do it like the Read It program. Do you guys remember that?
I was thinking like Oprah.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Like Oprah Book Club, where he's slapping on a bunch of books and then it sells.
Okay. So we need to partner with authors so we get a cut of this money.
Oh my gosh. No, I think we just pick a book and then we start reading. And encourage people to read it with us.
So are we going to read the last podcast book?
Obviously.
Wait.
I mean, maybe not for the Legendary Lasses book club. But it will be recommended. Okay, should we pick a first book for our Legendary Lasses redo? Give it a redo on the canon book club. We need a catchier name.
Well, we need a theme song. We need like, listen, let's get equipment first, you know?
Okay, fair. Let's
baby steps.
Once we have equipment and we can keep up to date on our website, then we can start this. But I think this is a really cool idea, maybe.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, is there anything else you guys want to say about her?
She seems like an interesting lady.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very intrigued by this quote in that interview.
Yeah.
Like, what? Girl, give me more deets. What's up? Build that to you, girl. Well, thanks for listening to my Louisa May Alcott episode, you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would one of you like to do the outro? Because I'm dying.
I'll do it. I'll try.
Okay.
Well, thank you all for listening. I forgot that last time. this has been Legendary Lasses. And if you want to find us, you can definitely do that. We're on all the social medias, pretty much all the big ones anyway. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Legendary Lasses. You can also email us. It's legendarylasses@gmail.com. And you can send us any suggestions you have, comments, anything like that. We'd love to hear from you. We also have a website, and it's legendarylasses.wordpress.com. And that's where we post anything to do with our episodes, all that. And you can also, if you feel so inclined, you can donate to us. It's anchor.fm/legendarylasses. And there's an option to support our podcast. Again, if you feel so inclined to do that, that's an option. Also, if you, we are on several platforms now. We're on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, all kinds of things. So if you do use a platform that has a ranking system, please feel free, give us a ranking and leave some comments there. That really helps us out. I did forget to mention, if you do choose to donate to us, all of that goes toward any equipment we might need, things like we've been talking about with getting equipment or resource materials for our research, things like that, just so you guys know. Am I forgetting anything? All right.
Quick little note before we do our like outro. I already told Sally this, but I was looking at our Anchor dashboard today. Mm-hmm. And we have a new country that got added.
Yes. What's our new country?
Norway.
Norway. Welcome, Norway.
Hi, Norway.
What's up, Norway?
That's awesome.
It's apparently an, I'm going to mess this pronunciation up and they're never going to listen to us again. But I think it's from Ostfold.
Okay.
In Fredrikstad.
Okay.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. If you want to run to the
family. What?
Said hello. Hello, Norway. Welcome to the family.
If you would like to write to us and tell us our pronunciation is terrible, then we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, tell me how to pronounce that.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So what countries do we have now so far besides the U.S.?
Besides the U.S., we have Canada, the United Kingdom, Austria, Australia, Spain, Ecuador, Germany, and Norway.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
We got hello.
And nobody ever talks to us.
I wish talk to us, please.
I want to talk to y'all. Okay, I think we're ready to do our outro.
Okay. Now go out, make waves, change history, and stay legendary.
And kick some ass.
Woo! Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, this is guys. A good episode.
Hey, thanks. I like
hey,
it.
Ashley.
Yeah.
Hey, yep. Ashley.
What up?
Pie's better than cake.
Well.